Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Highfield Church and to this term's Highfield Lecture. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for coming and giving up the barbecue and the time on the common and the nice sunny afternoon. We're looking forward to a great evening together. A few words of explanation as we start. If you haven't been here before, if you're caught short and you need the toilet, singular, then it is out to my right, your left, under there. Emergencies, well, it's where you came in. It's over the wings and back, round at the back, and in the unlikely event of landing on water, your life jackets are under the seats. We hold these Highfield lectures once a term. This is now, I think, our fourth one, where we invite somebody who's worth hearing, who's eminent, to come and talk to us on a subject that's relevant to university life, to church life, to living as Christians. And the way in which they were going to work this evening is that our speaker, I'm going to hand over to Mark Spearing in a moment, who will introduce the speaker, chair the evening. Glyn will talk, and we'll follow that by a time of question and answer with an open microphone. The mic will be on the stand there in the middle, so as Glyn is talking and you're thinking, I want to find out a little bit more about that, keep that question, and there'll be plenty of time for question and answer afterwards at that standing mic. And when we're finished, there'll be refreshments over the side there, some cakes and I think tea and coffee and refreshments and all the usual things that are there on a Sunday evening. All of that will be in here, and we also have a book table. Most important book on that is one entitled The Big Ego Trip, which is our speaker's own book. There are plenty of copies of that. We'd love to sell out this evening. They're only at £7 each. And as ever, with the opportunity with a bookstore, there are some things from the home team as well people have published. Peter May's book, The Search for God on the Path to Persuasion, giveaway at a fiver, well worth a read. Strongly recommend that one. Tricia Williams has a number of books there at £5.50 of pamphlets, largely to do with ministering to older people. And against Tricia Williams, Peter Williams, no relation, has a number of more philosophical books, particularly on C.S. Lewis, and they're also on that table. So as you go out this evening, after you've had your refreshments, pass the book table and do make use of that. That's enough of this sort of introduction. Welcome this evening. I'm going to hand over to Mark Spearing to chair this evening. Mark is a member of this church. He's a member of the group that looks after the relations with the university in this church, and he's one of the university pro-vice chancellors. So I'll hand over to Mark to chair the evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith. And oh, as if by magic, the microphone is on and clearly working first time. It is an enormous pleasure to welcome and introduce our speaker this evening, Professor Glyn Harrison. In the spirit of these Highfield lectures, we are looking to bring people who are leaders in their field and fields that intersect between Christianity and the general public. So topics that are of wider significance but firmly rooted in Christianity. And Glyn is superbly placed to deliver a fantastic lecture in that general vein. He is an emeritus now professor of psychiatry at the University of Bristol. He is without question a leader in the field of psychiatry. He has done A-grade research in the field of psychosis, schizophrenia, and psychiatric epidemiology, and has also provided policy advice to the Department of Health and the World Health Organization, and has found time to be president of his professional society, and also performed the thankless job of being a department head of psychiatry at Bristol. So unquestionably a leader in the field of psychiatry, but is also a leader in the field of Christianity, Christian organization, and Christian thought. He is a committed Christian and member of his church, a church plant currently, Emmanuel Church in Westbury Park, but is also a member of the Council of Reference for CPAS and also of TFT, and until recently was a member of the Crown Nominations Committee, which is the body that nominates bishops and archbishops to Her Majesty's government for confirmation in those roles. One of the most significant organisations, at least in the Anglican Church in this country. Since retirement, but even preceding retirement, he has talked, as he will tonight, on subjects at the intersection of psychology, neuroscience, psychiatry, and Christian faith. And 3 years ago, he published the book, The Big Ego Trip, which you've heard advertised by Keith and is also the subject of this lecture. Without stealing his thunder, the notion of self-esteem, self-determination, self-promotion is a significant body of thought in general publication, general populace at the moment. And I think it's a really good time to think, what is the Christian reaction from that? So please join me in welcoming Glyn Harrison, and we look forward to his talk on The Big Ego Trip. Glyn.
Well, yes, I'm on too. Excellent. Thank you. Mark, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. Thank you very much for coming on a really warm, balmy night where many of you would have thoughts of other possibilities, I'm sure, not least the barbecue. So thank you for being here. A big thank you to Keith and to Peter for their very kind invitation too, but it's great to be here. And what I'm going to do actually is to just stop talking about halfway through, just to take some thoughts that you may have, chip in, push back, or ask any questions, and then we'll have a more formal time of questions at the end. Well, human beings have this extraordinary, this unique capacity for self-awareness and self-consciousness, this quite unique ability for the I to draw back from the me and to contemplate this thing and to ask, what is this thing? Or rather, to ask, who is this person? And it's hard to try to answer that question. It's the question of identity, without landing quite quickly on the bigger philosophical underpinning question of significance. What is my significance? Who am I? What is my significance? What is my value? What is my worth? And these are big philosophical questions and positions psychology immediately in a broader philosophical framework. It doesn't function independently of those broader philosophical questions for which science can't answer. Who am I? What is our significance, our value here? And these are some of the most haunting questions of mankind. Bonhoeffer said, "Who am I? These lonely questions haunt us." Well, who are we? What is our worth? Significance. And if you think about it, you can see why we find ourselves asking questions of worth and value quite quickly when we contemplate ourselves, because it's hard to get through life very far without knowing what you're worth. It touches on two big areas of what it means to be a human being. It touches on our competency, that is, our ability to act effectively in the world. If you don't think you're worth anything, you don't think you have any significance, any value, it's hard to see how what you do can have value or be appreciated or have worth. It's hard to know why what you have to offer would make any difference around here if you have no sense of what your value is as a person. So it touches quite closely on this question of competence. It also touches quite profoundly on question of love. Am I loved as a person? If you're not worth anything, it's hard to... Why would anybody love you? And yet something about our humanity says, I want to be loved. I want someone to look my way. And equally, it's hard to love yourself, to offer somebody else your love if you're not worth anything? There's no significant value to you, this thing. And so we can see why this question of value is really important to human beings and the way we function on the face of the earth. It affects the way what we can do, our confidence. It affects our most profound loves, whether we can be loved and give love. So we may be beginning to understand why this is a big question for us. What's my worth? And why we spend so much of our lives trying to answer it. And I'm going to share with you four big ways in which we try to answer this question. What is my worth? How we try to get it. Get value. And I'll give you a bit of a spoiler. They're all failures. None of them work, but we'll go through them because every one of them, somewhere in this room, will be part of your life. So how do we try to find worth, to build up a sense of significance inside and value? Well, the first way is to be noticed. It'd be very hard if no one ever looked your way, wouldn't it? Just think what that would be like. You know, Adam Smith, the father of modern economics, he wrote in 1798, he put his mind to the question, what drives people on? Why are we such active? Why are we always wanting to do things? And this was his answer, Adam Smith. He said, to what purpose is all the toil and bustle of this world? What is the end of greed and ambition, of the pursuit of wealth and power and preeminence? What makes us do this stuff? Is it to supply food and drink and clothes? No, the wages of a poorest labourer can get you a pair of jeans down at Primark. What then are the advantages of that great purpose of human life, which we call bettering our condition? Here's his answer: to be observed, to be attended to be noticed. Deep human need, which he as an economist recognized, drives us to be noticed. Because when we're noticed, we feel that we have significance. When other people look our way and give us value and offer us their attention, we feel we have worth, don't we? And so that's one of the big ways of being noticed. But the second way of getting worth, being noticed, the second way is this: getting status and official recognition socially. And status is a deeply important part of being noticed, but it's something separate from it. It's where we sit in importance socially. This morning we were talking about the extraordinary instance how Jesus disavows one of the key social markers of status of the time, who gets to wash feet. If you got to wash feet, you were the bottom of the heap. That was for slaves, for the lowest servants, for, if you really stuck, for women. The lowest member. So it was a key social marker of status where you sat in society. And that was why the disciples said, well, I'm not going to do it. Because it's sending messages out about who I am, you see. And there's something about the human spirit that strives for hierarchy, for position, to be seen above, to be sitting above. And it's a very nice place to be when you can get it. Status. This chap likes being at the top. I don't know about the guys underneath. What do you think? And status is an intoxicating thing when you can get it. If you think we align lots of social economic goods with status, so you get the bigger car park space, you get the better PA, you get the bigger office on the nicer floor. All sorts of economic goods attached to status, which is why we pursue it, because you get the money. And then you can buy more things, the bigger car, which gives you more status, which gets your neighbours looking your way, and so you feel more important, significant, worthy. And it makes you feel good. In fact, it's not so much, the thing about status isn't so much even the Jaguar or the office. To be honest, it's just the intoxication of being above, being seen, the body language. It's great being a visiting speaker. You know, the way they fall back as you go through the door and you say, oh, no, please don't. But inside, you think, but thank you very much, you know? Because the human spirit, we like to be important. It feeds into our need. And it makes us feel good. Of course, the only problem with status, it also makes us feel very bad at the same time. Why? Why do you think? Why does having status also create anxiety, worry, insecurity? Why? Well, guilt kind of gnaws away, particularly if you have a Christian worldview which says this stuff is dross in the end. But leaving that aside, what other reason do you think we... You lose it. Friend, you always lose it. It is inevitable that you will lose it. Retirement comes, all that stuff you invest in. Those people whose views were so important to you. They clapped you and they came to your appreciation. Do they've forgotten who you are? The stuff you wanted, it broke down, it decayed, it got rusty. The house, you've got to downsize. You cannot keep this up. The people who you hungered for their being noticed, they found other people. Because the guys on the bottom, they don't like being at the bottom. And they're working hard to get up there. And you're getting slower and your memory's not so good. And your research is just getting a little creaky and a bit old. And you're beginning to decline. And so it makes us anxious and insecure status. But because so much is staked on it, we have to keep on running. So that's the second way. So being noticed, getting status. And sorry, I think what let me put status under that first way, actually. I'd forgotten, I condensed those two. So let's put status under being noticed, a part of being noticed. But the second way, okay, so being noticed, the second way is being accepted. And I know quite a few, and I want to avoid gender stereotypes, but there probably is a male-female difference here, because so many women have said to me when I've talked about hierarchy and getting up the ladder, they've said, you know, Glenn, that's quite a male thing. More of a, now there are many women who are like that, but in general, maybe if you're a woman, you think about this differently. It's more about being included, being accepted for the value that you have. Your gifts being recognized in the system rather than climbing up and down. That can be. Now let's not get into stereotype, but that broad difference, whatever its cause, nature or nurture, may be there. But being accepted, being included is an important part of getting our worth as well. And sometimes we don't want to just be accepted by the folk around us. We want to be accepted by sometimes voices in our own heads from the past, people who are important to us. I remember someone said to me once, they said, why do people do this? High jump. She said, you know, what do they do? You practice all of that time and you work at it. And you just get over the bar, finally. And what do they do next? They always move it higher. And she said, my father was like that. And no matter how hard I tried, no matter how high I jumped for him as the eldest daughter, I was never good enough. And if I'm honest, I'm still jumping and running and striving. I want him to accept me. And he's dead. And I'm still running. So, being noticed and getting status, being accepted and included, sometimes from significant people in our history. And the third one is being in control. If you can get control for a while, control's great, isn't it? Get control. That feeling you have after you've been, things are falling apart, you go out for a jog maybe, and you get things back under control. Sometimes it can be food becomes the kind of area. If I can get food under control, and that can become dangerously clinical with anorexia and bulimia, as it becomes the area that if I can just get control in this area, I have control in every area. Some people, not all people at all, see it like that. But different areas, if we can get control, it means that we have value and significance. So who's this chap? Johnny Wilkinson. Now, it's all a bit out of date, this illustration, because it was 2003 now. On the 26th of November, England versus Australia. 9 seconds before the end, something like that. He wins the cup for England. We become world champions in rugby, or we win the Rugby World Cup. And he clinched it just with a perfect drop goal just before the end of the match. And in some ways, that was everything that that little boy, when he first went out on to the pitch at age 8, everything he dreamed of. Perfect goal. And yet he says within hours of that kick, not years, not days, not months, but within hours of that kick, he said this: I was tumbling out of control. Out of control. Why? Because you see, I'm only as good as my last kick. I'm afflicted with a powerful fear of failure, and I didn't know how to free myself from it. And so I was just kicking and getting control, but then I've got to kick again. It's got to be perfect kick, and just get the control and the perfectionism and just another turn of the screw. And you realize on the end, this is a treadmill. It's a treadmill because you can never get significance that way, because you are only as good as your last kick. And that's the problem with all of these very human, natural methods, aren't they, of getting worth, getting significance, is that in the end, they don't deliver. You just have to keep on running. They are a treadmill of searching for worth. So, being noticed, being accepted, getting control. You can probably think of others. Those are the big three, and none of them work. They just keep you running. So along came our fourth method. Our fourth method is called the self-esteem movement. It grew out of the work of people like Norman Vincent, what's his name? Price, wasn't it? Peale, sorry, yes, I think it was a P, thank you, one of those senior moments. But power of positive thinking and being positive about yourself. And the self-esteem movement was also rooted in some quite sophisticated psychology, which I'll come back to, which actually made the right diagnosis. What it said is, the problem with all of these things, being noticed, putting in effort, being driven, all of these things, is that they are contingent. They are contingent actions. The self-worth you get from them is contingent. It's always dependent on your managing to keep going with them. And so that's the problem. It's contingency. And what we need is a source of self-worth, of worth of ourselves, which is non-contingent, which isn't captive to every chance wind of whether I get the promotion or whether I don't, or whether she likes me or whether she doesn't. So where do you get non-contingent self-worth from, you see? Where do you get that? It doesn't matter what you do and who you are. You're valuable. Where would you get that from? Who can say that you're that kind of valuable? The self-esteem movement was great in its diagnosis, but this was its solution. It said, you say what your worth is. Self-esteem. The self esteems itself. It sounds good on the face of it, because no one can take away from you what you say. You say, I don't care what you think. I think I'm a person of value, you see. And so this was the basis of what we might call the self-esteem movement. And whilst there are dimensions of this that are important and right, in its popular version, nevertheless, it's penetrated our society hugely, the idea that we need to look after ourselves, put ourselves first, love ourselves, like ourselves. And that's the solution to self-worth. You just say, it's easy. And so we have the birth and development of the self-esteem movement. And there's some reason to think that this was worth looking at, because we know from a lot of research that self-worth, low self-worth, does correlate with lots of mental health conditions, with mental health broadly, with academic achievement, actually, with crime and social deviance, with substance misuse. All of these kinds of social pathologies, mental health issues within mental health, depression, anorexia, panic disorder, substance misuse, all of these have been found to correlate with having low self-esteem. So you can see the seduction of this. If we can boost people's self-esteem, we've hit the jackpot. We raise the whole population's mental health. We academic achievements better. This is the cure to get us liking ourselves much more. And substance misuse is reduced. This is like a social vaccine. And if we can get it out there and roll it out into our schools, self-worth, then we will potentially bring about a revolution in the human condition. You say it's a bit exaggerated. Actually, that isn't all that exaggerated from some of the early political aspirations here. The governor of California set up a whole self-esteem a policy for the whole of the, back in the 70s, early 80s, for the whole of the, to be rolled out across the whole of the state. And he said, if we can get kids like a vaccine, vaccinate them against low self-esteem by getting them to say, I'm important, then who knows? He actually said, taxes may even go up, so it's good for government. You see? It's good for everybody. And you can see, if we can just get this self-esteem. And so in its popular form particularly, it became very prevalent. You just need to love yourself. I love me. Say stuff like these. These are called positive self-statements or self-affirming statements. I am powerful, unlimited, strong, certain. If you go to the website of the American Self-Esteem Association, you can download a pack of these or order them, and you can sort of meditate on them over your lunch time. I attract positive people and events to my life now, you see. And if you've got a kid, you've got to start them earlier. And if you're of a religious turn of mind, you can recruit God to feeling good about yourself. And you give, this is a bib, and it says, I may be little, but to God, I'm big stuff. Actually, it's quite cute, isn't it? But it's part of a broader social movement to big up ourselves in the hope that this is the answer to low self-esteem. The self affirms its self. I am special. Not just unique, of course. Every one of us is unique, but special is unique with a twist of greatness about it. I am special. Now, I just want you to think about I am special, because take my grandkids, take your grandkids, take your kids, take someone who's very close. They're special to you. You love them. People will not get in the way of your love for them. They're special to you. But do I want them to grow up thinking they're going to be special to everybody? That they're just special? Because if so, they're in for a big disappointment. because they're going to find in the big wide world they're lined up with everybody else. And they're all running, and they're all working, and they're all trying on the same treadmill to keep up with being special, being ahead, and being one above. But your special is one of the, you know, the things that's wheeled out in many schools, and some schools still have self-esteem policies. I think schools are moving on from this now for reasons that will become clear, but the self-esteem movement, friends, do not underestimate the power that this has had, the social influence of this movement to change the way we think about education and about childhood development and in terms of our advertising tactics and our modes of thought generally as human beings. You see our preoccupation with this, for example. This is just newspaper articles, publications in major news outlets on self-esteem. And you can see that since the birth of the movement, back there in the 60s, 70s, 80s, now it's 2000, you can see how we get this mushrooming of interest in this is popular media. Even within psychology, self-esteem grew to be one of the top three most researched areas. It's sort of falling by the wayside and fallen by the wayside now for, again, reasons we're coming to. But there was an explosion. And we can begin to measure some of the impact of this in people's attitudes. Jennifer Twenge, who I quote there, Twenge and Campbell, she's done some extraordinarily patient gathering together of data sets, standardizing the data as far as possible, making adjustments, and tracking how people's attitudes toward themselves have been changing over the decades. And in her book, Narcissism, or The Narcissism Epidemic, they show a lot of this data, and I have that cited at the end. But for example, she found that in one study carried out in the mid-90s, the average male college student in America had a higher self-esteem than 86% of male college students back in 1968. She went on to find that college students were significantly more likely now in the mid-90s compared with then in the late 60s, 70s to agree with statements such as, I take a positive attitude toward myself. In the early 50s, for example, 12% of teens agreed with the statement, I am an important person. By the late 80s, early 90s, an incredible 80% agreed with that. Now, I'm not going to get into debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I just quote that, cite that, to illustrate the penetration of the self-esteem movement, the way it got us thinking differently about our attitude to ourselves. And you see these global judgments about ourselves beginning to show through in... These are student, again, American, and you may want to raise questions about how well all of this stuff translates over here. But these are American students who rate their abilities above average. And you can see that, for example, leadership ability between the years 1970 and then 2010 has been progressively going up in terms of the proportion who rate themselves as above average. Okay. And similarly with the other competences, intellectual self-confidence going up. So when we answer questions about self-confidence, intellectual ability, these competences, we have been schooled to take a more positive, confident view of ourselves. And that shows through in these data. And it's all part of the self-esteem movement's, not only its diagnosis, but its cure. Think positively about yourself. And the big question, of course, that we're all wondering is, does it work? Because if it works, well, we're interested. Does it work? Well, how are we doing on time? I think what I'd love to do is stop for a moment and take any comments You know, this isn't just tablets of stone with me. If you've got any thoughts, chip in. If anything rings a bell, if it doesn't, but I'd love to hear you. I'm just going to repeat what you say for the microphone, but we won't go to the official mic just now. But if you want to shout anything out, or if you've got a question, just shout it out just now. Yes. No, no, I can, but I'm thinking of the people at the back. Can just shout.
Okay, I'll try to shout. Christ said to love your neighbour as you love yourself.
Yes.
How is that relevant to this
situation? Great question, isn't it? Jesus did say, love your neighbour as yourself. And people often quote that as Jesus giving a talk about self-esteem. In fact, he was simply building on our default tendency to look after ourselves. He's using love in the sense of self-care, self-attention. And we do that. We get out of bed, we make ourselves a cup of tea ourselves. We get one in the morning. We, except your husband, obviously, and you have to do that for him. I see that. But the default is still to be looked after in that case. So he's saying just as all your defaults, your natural instincts are towards self-preservation and care, do the same thing to other people with the same measure of investment and interest, you see. Now, and I think that's his point there. He's not really giving a talk about the importance of self-love, but when he says, consider the lilies of the field, you know, how much more your Father loves you, he's clearly saying that God's love brings into the human spirit a profound sense of ballast, being loved by God, and we'll come on to this at the end. So there is something about God's love creating in us and providing the framework for a sense of worth and value. But I don't think he was saying, hey, you've got to be positive about yourself in a slightly American accent there. You know, you've got to love yourself. I don't think that was really the thrust of what he's saying when he was teaching that. But you may want to disagree later when we have a coffee. Yes, any other? Yes, please. That's a really good question, yes. How much of this is genetically a part of a, you know, there's a genetic factor involved? And the answer to that is yes, there have been associations. As in most complex human behaviours, you'll find associations. What precisely the pathway is and what the nature of that association is quite hard to untangle. As you know, I don't know what, but with all complex human behaviours, you get genetic associations, but you can't be sure that the gene is actually associated with that behaviour, but rather something that underlies it, that's on the pathway toward it. So, for example, there is a genetics, I'm sure, of being a professor of psychiatry. There'll be some associations there with that. And you think, wow, there's a gene for being a professor of psychiatry. No, there are associations with being a professor of psychiatry because it takes a certain, maybe, intelligence level, and you're actually just measuring a gene association with a certain intelligence level, the kind of people who get to university, say. So, you know, big pinches of salt are needed, as you probably know, with gene associations. But nevertheless, you know, there's a bit of literature out there suggesting that genetic factors play into our constitution in different, very highly complex ways. So, any other, please? Yes, please. And I forgot to repeat the question, didn't I, though? The question was, are genetic factors? Yes, please. Yes.
Where on that graph were they? Around about a half of the people thought they were above average. Depending on your interpretation of average, you would perhaps expect half to actually be above average and half to be below average.
Yes, yeah. Can we look at that one later? Do you mind? Because, right, that might get us... do you mind if we do that later rather than go back? All right, yeah, but and we'll talk about that later if that's okay. Yes, thank you. Yes. Yes, so the question is, if you are brought up with a parent with low self-esteem, it may be that they will model for you a way of relating to the world which is built on the premise that you're not up to much yourself either. Mum, look at the way Mum, she's, her whole body language says, excuse me for being here. And so that would be a powerful modelling factor. Of course, we mustn't oversimplify, because some kids would grow up thinking, I'm never going to be like Mum. Oh, no. You know, and because they get a different set of life experiences at school and so on, their self-concept, self-understanding, and their value about themselves is modelled differently. But that's a good point. Do you want to come back in? Yes? It could be a... Yes, so there's a kind of a generational issue, you think, that you'd say in a way, perhaps in previous generations, we have beaten people down, and we've not nurtured people's sense of being, I would say, made in the image of God, loved by God, profoundly significant in his eyes. Now, how do you nurture a child with that sense of significance? And I think we lost sight of that in the past. You know, children should be seen. I'll take another question if I might in a minute. We'll talk a bit later. But how do you, you know, because children should be seen and not heard. No one wants to go back to those days. I think what I'm putting a big question mark of is whether we've gone to the other extreme now of over-emphasising importance in a way that isn't actually serving our children's interests very well. Yes, there's somebody over there. Yes, please.
Where do you get self-esteem from? Where is, what are the social norms that we value our social esteem, self-esteem against? Because in our society, you've got a big cop, you've got self-esteem, but if you're an Aboriginal,
if you're a, sorry?
Aboriginal.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Where does that get?
Generated.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting point. You're just saying that some markers of self-esteem, a marker of self-esteem in one society and another, it's a lump of metal. You know, what do you do with this? And I just think you're making the point that the relative importance of social markers are generated socially. And so because a Jaguar has... seen as having carrying status, it's generated socially, it carries a broad degree of social recognition, it's nurtured in us by the advertising industry, we go after that thing. But you're absolutely right in another. And so that makes these markers so that makes them even more ephemeral, because they're so socially, contextually dependent in that sense. In the first place. Yes. Yes, what a great question. Yes, I think we're into a circular loop, to be honest. Well, and do you think science has the answer to that question? You know, because it's a deep, profound philosophical question, is what is it about being human that makes us say, who am I? What is my significance? You know, and science can never give us the answer to that. Psychology can't give us the answer to it. And it is a profound philosophical one. And I think one of the problems of the self-esteem movement is that it has sort of it's sort of brushed aside those deeper philosophical questions that actually it pivots around, and you know, created a false security. Just love yourself, be fine. Well, I think what we'll do... Yes, I'll just have one there and then we'll move on. Yes.
I wonder if you can just put up, immediately preceding a dip in the percentage of people, or the proportion that believe they're above average.
Yeah.
A peak in intellectual self-confidence. What's the relationship between...
Ooh, do you know, can we take that one later as well? The reason I don't want to go back to that graph and get a bit too bogged down in it. All I wanted to do was to show you the broad sweep of attitudinal change. And I agree, there are lots of interesting bits and pieces in there. But just the broad sweep, that was all. Do you mind I'm so sorry, just bear with me, because I just sense we might end up getting a bit bogged down in some of those details. So let's move on, because I think the question we're itching to ask, well, does all of this work? And there's a lot of data out there. And I think probably three of the main people who've surveyed the data are Roy Blaumeister, Nicholas Emler, and Jennifer Tweng. And it actually wasn't until the late 90s that the American Psychological Association got round to some really serious overview assessments of whether self-esteem is causal, as causal as we think. And Blaumeister was charged with doing that because he'd been one of the very early advocates and researchers in self-esteem. And he carried out a major literature review. And just to say that what I'll do is I'll post these slides with some references at the end and resources. But they're posted on a website, humbly named, glynharrison.com. If you just go to that and go to the resources, and these slides will be posted on the resources page at the end, but not for about 10 days, I'm afraid, because I'm going on holiday tomorrow, so it won't get done. But they will be there. And Roy Blaumeister, and again, he's referenced in the book Ego Trip, if you want to look at his work, he looked and he said, is this association between low self-esteem and all of these adverse outcomes, educational, mental health, substance misuse, crime, is this association a causal association? Because as we know, correlation does not equal causation. And looking at the data, he said it's very clear. There's no evidence of causation. It's very hard. He certainly concluded, as did Nicholas Emler from the London School of Economics here, and Jennifer Tweng back in America, there's no evidence that self-praise boosting of children delivers the health, educational, or social outcomes that were claimed. No evidence that that actually works. Boosterism, you're special, believe in yourself. And in fact, they concluded it may cause more harm than good by increasing insecurity with this focus on the self and staying up there and being special, being set apart. Have a look at this a bit more. This idea that it's really a significant causal factor. This will be an example of the kind of work Bowden, this is carried out on the Dunedin birth cohort, one of the best birth cohorts in the world. It's small in numbers, but fantastic in quality. And their follow-up rates of a cohort of children born in a certain year in Dunedin, in New Zealand, their follow-up of them over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, 35 years now, I think is fantastic. And what they're able to do is to make lots of measurements and then see a few years later what the relationships are. And they found in the Dunedin cohort a clear correlation, association between risky sexual behaviours at age 16 and earlier measures of self-esteem at age 11, you see. And so, hey presto, we should boost the self-esteem and then the kids are much more cautious about sexual behaviours. They'll use precautions, they'll be less reckless in their sexual choices and partners. That would be the thinking. But actually, when they just then carried out some fairly simple controls and adjustments to their data for things, for example, like social class and the history of sexual abuse and IQ and family stability, they found that self-esteem as a contributory factor drops out of the equation. That both risky sexual behaviours and low self-esteem are together both being caused by something else. In this case, a history of sexual abuse or low social class and so on. And so you see, what we're uncovering is that self-esteem is just often on the pathway to something. And both the self-esteem and that something, whether it's risky sexual behaviours or substance misuse or poor education, that they're all related to something else in the background. And actually, doesn't that add up? Life is always more complex than we'd like it to be. There's no holy grail, certainly in the sphere of psychiatry, psychology. We're too complex to have found some simple vaccine that we just boost kids' self-esteem and we all live happily. It was never going to work because our humans were too complex for that. And so it proved to be, as summarised in the work, and I think it is the best work of Blaumeister and Nicholas Emler. But of course, does actually boosting people, these self-affirming statements, do they work? I'm confident, I attract people to me. This is an interesting piece of work, again, cited, referenced. I'm afraid it's dropped off at the bottom, but it's from the University of Hamilton, Ontario. And it's about 6 years old now, and it's a nice piece of work. It's a randomized trial. And what they did was they took a group of people, randomized them to three conditions. In the first, they were given a pack of these self-affirming statements. And this was a study, really, that set out by saying, we've been telling people to be confident. Do self-affirming statements actually work? Do they deliver the outcomes we want? Let's do a trial. You think, well, we've been doing it for 20 years. We're only just now getting around doing a trial? Yes, strangely. So we do a decent trial here, and we randomly allocate. The first group get these self-affirming statements. The second group, the one in the middle, they get the same pack of statements. And the third group get nothing at all. Okay. Now, the first group are told to meditate positively for half an hour a day on those statements. It's a kind of a little selfie quiet time. I am strong. I attract people. Meditate. You see? And the group in the middle, they're given the same statements, but they were told to meditate on how this is true of me, I'm special, and how it's not true of me, but not that special. So evaluate this statement, meditate on that. And the third group were just told to have half an hour to themselves and just to reflect on the day's events. Well, what happened when they followed them up 3 and 6 months later? What's interesting is that the group that got the self-affirming statements and were focusing positively on them, the individuals in that group who had low self-esteem at the beginning of the study, whether that's partly genetic, constitutional, parents, whatever had fed into that, had low self-esteem at the beginning, they actually felt worse at the end about themselves. And the authors conclude, positive self-statements, they may help people who already feel good about themselves feel a bit better, but they seem to backfire for the people who need them most. They feel worse. Why? Why do you feel worse, friends? Because it's hard to believe your own propaganda. And at the end of the day, self-esteem is that. If it is not contextualized in something deeper, bigger, thicker than just my opinion. And that's the conundrum that faces and has always faced the self-esteem movement. You know, how much can I rely on what I say for who I am? Instinctively, we look elsewhere for the answer to the question, who am I, these lonely questions of mine, Bonhoeffer. There is accumulating evidence as well that there are costs of the self-esteem movement as well. There are evidence hitting. This is some work by a psychologist called Jennifer Crocker. She's done some really interesting work where she's looked at the effects of trying to boost your self-esteem on different kinds of people. She found that in general, it increases contingency. In other words, rather than winkling you off these behaviours like running and trying to get control and so on, by focusing you so much on how I feel today and what my value is, it actually exacerbates the situation. Because our self-worth is so, it's too fragile to depend entirely on our own propaganda. And Crocker, as a secular psychologist, she scratches her head and she says, the self and its notion of its worth needs to be rooted in something thicker, bigger. Now, what will that be as a psychologist? There's no psychological answer to that. It's a philosophical question. So she comes up with a philosophical answer and says it's in eco-care. It's in caring about the world and having an outward view. And so for her, human flourishing is about being part of a story, a cause, a movement that's bigger than you, which for her is caring for the world. And that is a way in which we begin to experience a sense of worth as we participate in that calling and we say, this is who I am, I'm an eco-warrior. So my sense of worth isn't just because I say so, it's because I have a sense of purpose, an identity, you see. And that ultimately is where we go looking for our sense of worth, our sense of identity. We are looking for a bigger story. And so a humanist would go looking for a sense of their selves in a humanistic framework, which we may want to argue the validity of that, because ultimately it too depends on man's ability to be the measure of his own worth. But we need something. And the big question then is, what will it be? I just want to mention a couple of more things of the risks of the self-esteem movement. There's evidence it decreases empathy. And she's got some nice experiments which shows that people who are concentrating on raising their self-esteem, that's the main road of their mental life, that it's such hard work doing that because it's all so fragile and self-absorbing, they lose empathy, you see. It's hard to be worried about somebody else when you're so worried about yourself. That was her conclusion. She found, along with Carol Dweck, if you're a teacher here, you've probably read some of the work of Carol Dweck and her mindset work. Very interesting. That children who are praised for their qualities and their sense of status actually become less hardworking than kids who are praised for their effort. And so Carol Dweck's done a lot of work to show how don't boost kids' sense of their self-importance, boost sense of pride in their effort. Because the one closes you down on yourself and the other opens you out into the world. Now you're scratching your head maybe thinking, what does he mean by this? Let me give you an example. She took a sample of children and she divided them into two groups and they had relatively simple tasks to perform. And they were coached by two kinds of teachers. The first set of teachers rewarded their successes with quality statements like, you're special. I think you're really intelligent. You did that well. You must be really intelligent, you see. Special, intelligent. What do we have here? A little Mozart in the making or what? Wow, Einstein here. This boy has got a brain. All of these are quality statements that boost a child's sense of status. Now, the teachers over here, they were schooled to do it quite differently, which is, you worked hard at that. Well done. Look at the effort you put into that. This bit here, a bit more work needed on that. But you're trying hard. And look at the results of it. And you keep going with that. And so this is rewarding effort with praise versus rewarding effort with status and quality affirmation. Now, what she did after we'd praised these kids in these two different ways is she says, now, kids, we're going to do another test. And she says, but you can choose the test. And basically, she gives them a very difficult test, a moderately difficult and an easy one, and the kids can see which is which. Now, the kids over here who've been praised for being special or being intelligent, what do you think they choose, the easier or the harder? The easier. Why? Because if you've been told you're a prince, hard to discover you're a frog. So the kids become risk-averse and self-protective. And ego becomes a fragile thing that mustn't be disturbed and mustn't be offended. And we've got to have trigger warnings in our university to make sure that my fragile sense of self... Now, every university has to place limits on what can be said in the sense of abusive behaviour to others. Of course that's true. But we're seeing developments on campuses at the moment where there's with trigger warnings and this sense of fragility. And I find myself asking, how much of this has a generation of kids who've been brought up, they're so fragile, so special, the ego must be protected. You may want to push back on that one. But the kids over here who are encouraged for their effort, they choose the harder ones, you see, because they want to know more about the world. They want to do more in the world. They give it a try. And if they don't get it right first time, if at first you don't succeed, try again. It's a different way being in the world. And the self-esteem movement has nurtured this way and not that way. And Carol Dweck says that's to our great detriment. I remember doing this once myself. I was skiing at the end of a conference, very important conference. And then at the end, a little group of us went off because it was near the mountains, and we took 3 days holiday every other year. And we went around and we were roughly the same level, and 2 or 3 days we enjoyed. And then I remember one day, a group came, we just stopped to catch our breath, our little group. Another group threw the off-piste. And they came and they drew in beside us. And I recognised one of them as somebody I know, a friend. And I knew they were keen because this was the days before most people wore helmets, but they all had helmets on. And my friend, let's call him John, he said, Glyn, he said, come and join us. It's great. We've got a guide here. And... he's going to take us off piste. Let's all go. Come and join us. And I thought for a microsecond and said, no, thanks, John. I'll stay with my friends here. Thank you very much, though. And so off they went. And one of the group, people in my group, said, interesting, isn't it? He said, Glyn would rather be the best in this group than the average in that. And it's a little cameo of what Carol Dweck was discovering, that if we over-massage the ego of our kids, we're not drawing out the best in them. It's the wrong kind of confidence. So she says, praise effort. Because in praising effort, you know, tangentially, you're drawing out a sense of significance in that person who's making a difference to the world like this. So... it increases contingency, it decreases empathy, it reduces effort, but also possibly increases narcissism. And Carol Dweck has shown that Jennifer Twenge, this is her tracking data for narcissism rates measured by something called the NPI, the Narcissism Personality Inventory, between 1982 and 2006. And she says over the period of boosterism, you can see that narcissism, indexed by this simple measure in healthy college student populations, has been going up. Now, we all know to say, don't we, that correlation doesn't equal causation. So it doesn't mean that just because the two have been going up together, self-esteem and narcissism, the two are necessarily causally linked. But I just put it out there because there's a plausible reason to say that they possibly are, even though we can't prove that the moment. So these are the kind of harms that psychologists are beginning to talk about now as being a product of the self-esteem movement. And once again, we're driven back to this question that our self-worth needs to be nested in a matrix of self, a self-understanding, an identity, a matrix of identity, which is thicker than me. And where do we get that? Well, as I said earlier, if you're a humanist, you would say, well, I think I get it here. If you're an eco-warrior, you'd... So there are different worldviews, and we need to test and probe those worldviews. But I'm proud, thrilled to be part of the Christian worldview. Because what I think the Christian worldview does, if you take it seriously, is it begins to answer profoundly these deep questions of identity. Who am I? And as we draw to a close with this, let me read some words from John's Gospel, some of those greatest words in Scripture. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. John 1, verse 1. Then, verse 14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We've seen his glory. Glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, what does that say? Bonhoeffer's question, who am I? These lonely questions of mine. Who am I? What those verses tell us is, friends, when we ask that question, we are not alone. He is there. The creator of the worlds, sustainer of the universe. He is there. You're not alone. And when we say, well, do I have to make up my self-worth for myself? Do I just have to say, I am special? Or is there something else I can pin or pivot my sense of value around? The answer here is yes, he has spoken. He's not left us in the dark to make all of this up as we go along. The creator of the worlds has spoken. He became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace, truth. And when we say, well, what did he say? Did he say anything about us? We say, well, first he said something about himself. He revealed himself first. Because that's what you really want to know if God's around. You want him to reveal himself, don't you? And he revealed himself in the person of Jesus, full of grace, truth. We saw this morning how he... this God, this serving God, strips off his clothes and stoops. And when we, our instinct is to go up in pride, his is to go down in love. The kind of God he is. He reveals himself. And we say, thank God for that. I'm interested. And does he say anything else? And we discover that not only does he reveal who he is in the gospel, he reveals who we are as well. Verse 12, for as many as received him, for as many as received him, to them gave he the right to become, to be called, to be identified as children of God, born not of human flesh, human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. And link that back to Genesis. Human, male, female, made in the image of God himself. Dreadfully disfigured in the fall. But now, in John, restored, being restored again. Transfigured into the image of Christ himself. God's own son. That is our identity. And what we want, friends, when we say, what is my significance? We want somebody to name us. We want someone to tell us what we're worth, to tell us our name, who we are, where we sit in the great scheme of things. And he says, I call my sheep by name. By name. God of the worlds. And here, I want to suggest, friend, is the thick view of ourselves, identity, in which we discover our true worth. Because it sits on, it rides on, it pivots around the love of God, which is unconditional. And therefore, the worth that it generates in the human heart is unconditional. It doesn't depend on those things, on whether they like you, or whether you performed well that day, or whether they approve of you, or what that feedback was. It doesn't ride on those things. Your sense of identity pivots around the will of God in your life and his naming of you and saying, you made in my image and transfigured, being transfigured into the image of my son. And I tell you, eye hasn't seen, nor ear heard, nor the mind of man conceived what God has in store for you, his image bearer. So live out of that, out of it. Can I just go back to the slide a moment? You know, Ernst Becker, the anthropologist, said most of our life is in large part a rationalization of our failure to find out who we really are, what our basic strength is, what thing it is that we were meant to work on upon the world. Well, friends, that is the despair of secularism. And we, as those who are Christians, have a message which is about who we are. Identity that tells us who we are. For the Christian, at least, identity is not discovered in the self. You know, look within yourself. No. It's not constructed by the self. It is revealed to the self by the God who names us. And the task, of course, now, for those who are Christians, is to live out of that. And those of us who are, maybe you're here just thinking about these things tonight, I'd just love to invite you to think about these deep questions of significance and worldview and how it affects and shapes your life and your loves, what you go after. And just to say, is there something here in this worldview, and I need to look at it and I need to think it through, but is there something here that's I don't know, it's deeper, wider, somehow more secure, there's ballast in it that my heart is looking for? And I think that's the wonderful message here. I think what I'll do is I'll finish here with one last thing. Because I know lots of you are thinking, well, this all sounds okay, but how does it work out in practice? And this is one of my burdens, actually. And in the book Ego Trip, I try to look at some of these practical questions toward the end and try and give some tricks and ways of approaching it. Because, of course, it sounds good, my identity is in Christ. We say it all the time. But then we go into work and we get some bad feedback and we're all over the place. And we think, well, I said my identity was in Christ yesterday, but it's actually in the fact that I didn't get that promotion today. That's what my heart's saying right now. You know, I often use the illustration, and I've pinched it from Jonathan Haidt, who I'm a great fan of, psychologist, social psychologist in the States. You know, the human heart, the human person, it's like an elephant with a little man on top. And the little man is our rational, intellectual, thinking selves, very important. He steers the elephant. But the elephant is a creature of habit. He's walked this path for a long, long time. And we've been thinking about some new instructions to the elephant, to the man on the elephant. We say, my identity is not in Christ. That's right, my identity is not in my efforts and my work. It's in Christ. And the little man says, yes, I got that. Thank you. That's clear. And so, elephant, we need to go this way, you see. But what happens on Monday morning when we go in and get that feedback is the elephant says, "Oh, I've been here before." And he goes this way again because he's got a long memory and is a creature of habit. And you have the little man on top's hitting him. But the elephant's a big, big beast, a heart, the habits of that. So what lies behind that question is, how do I put this into practice? Is you're saying, my little man, he hears what you're saying, but the elephant, I know next week's going to be tramping down the same road. And that's a big question, and it is a long, slow process. I'm 67, folks. I'm still at this calling. Not to pin who I am on what people think, but to be rooted in God's love, which is always unconditional. And there are a number of things you can do, and I'll just finish with one suggestion. And here it is. Evaluate your service, not your identity. That's a little trick, and it takes you all your life to learn. But what it means, we are instinctive as human beings, evaluators. It's what we do. We evaluate. So you'll go out and say, "That was terrible, wasn't it?" Or, "That was really helpful." Or you'll be evaluating. "I didn't like the way he kept doing that with his hands, did you?" Or, "Do you know who he reminded me of?" So we're evaluating the world all the time around us in different ways. And in terms of importance, lesser importance, what's right, what's wrong. We're instinctive evaluators. And the problem is we're constantly evaluating ourselves. And what the Christian gospel calls us to is to stand apart from that, to root. Your identity is untouchable by whether you do good today or ill, whether you succeed or whether you fail. You're still made in the image of God. You bear his image graciously and gracefully as his child. So that is untouchable by what happens. So don't evaluate who you are. But do evaluate your service, your work, your achievements. You can evaluate those, but try and keep the two separate. And it's a tough task, but you can do it. I'm learning to do it better. So I think I, you know, mended that car puncture pretty well there. I'm pretty good at mending punctures, I've decided. Doesn't make me a great person, hasn't altered who I am, doesn't for one moment affect. Let's up the game a bit. I got a first, let's say. I didn't actually, myself. But I got a first, you know. You got a first. Well done, friend. You did that. The whole point of God saying, "Well done, good and faithful servant," is that our actions have real meaning in his economy. It matters to him what we do, and we do it in his strength, but we still do it. So evaluate the service. Feel his reward and pleasure in us when we do well. Feel his disapproval when we do badly. And keep trying in God's strength. But none of that affects your identity, who you are. You got a first, but you're still a sinner, saved by grace. And now you're a saint. Now, some little tricks in doing that, but it's part of the pathway to wholeness, whereby we find ourselves less rooted in what they think and their approval and my achievement, and more rooted in what God is and what he says and what his love means. And I think with that I will stop. Thank you so much. And can I hand back, I think, now to Mark, don't I? Thanks, Mark.
Well, let's give Glyn a